Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight we have a lecture presented by the Boston University African American Studies Program and co-sponsored by the Anthropology Department and the African Studies Center. Our speaker is Dr. Mark Auslander, Associate Professor of Anthropology and Museum Studies and Director of the Museum of Culture and Environment at Central Washington University. Dr. Auslander's lecture is titled, The Accidental Slave Owner, Revisiting a Myth of Race and Finding an American Family. We begin with an introduction by Linda Haywood, Director of Boston University's African American Studies Program.
Today we are very pleased to have with us a colleague of mine for many years and who has really done some fantastic work that we're all interested in hearing, and his name is Mark Auslander. He's Associate Professor of Anthropology and Museum Studies and Director of the Museum of Culture and Environment in Central Washington University in Ellensburg, Washington. He is a sociocultural anthropologist with strong interest in political and symbolic processes in Africa and the African diaspora. His principal ethnographic research has been in Eastern Zambian Ngoni communities and among African American families in rural Georgia, USA. He received his undergraduate and graduate training in anthropology at the University of Chicago. His academic writings explore a wide range of topics, including South Central African witch-finding movements, popular contests over South African nature reserves, Zulu iconography in global context, the art of Southern Sudanese refugees, the social meanings of lynching photography, popular narratives of slavery in the rural American South, African American cemeteries and family reunions, contemporary Afro-Atlantic art and living history reenactments of traumatic events, including lynching and slave auctions. He has consulted at the Smithsonian on the African Voices exhibition project and worked on Without Sanctuary, Lynching Photography in America at the Martin Luther King Jr. National Historic Site in Atlanta. With his students and community members, he has collaborated, curated exhibitions of African and African American art, as well as family and cultural history. During the summer of 2011, he served as a senior fellow at the Smithsonian's National Museum of African Art. His first book, The Accidental Slave Owner, Revisiting a Myth of the American South, emerges out of collaborated work with his students and community members in Oxford, Georgia, as they help to restore and document the city's historically African-American cemetery. They gradually came to realize that the city was profoundly divided by different relations to the story of Miss Kitty, an enslaved woman who lived during the first half of the 19th century. Researching Miss Kitty's story and how she has been remembered across the generations led Mark on a long journey of oral, historical, and archival research, culminating in making contact with Miss Kitty's living descendants. The Accidental Slave Owner is the result of this collaborative journey. And really, Mark, welcome again. It's a long time we worked on the Smithsonian project, and I always have been in, you know, contact. So give us a welcome.
Thank you, Linda, for that warm and generous introduction. It's wonderful to be back at Boston University, back at African American Studies, and to see so many friends in so many different parts of the university. And beyond. So I'm going to talk a little bit tonight about this book, The Accidental Slave Owner, and some of the stories that it tells. And it's as you will notice, this title, An Accidental Slave Owner, is a somewhat in-your-face title. It's a disturbing title. What does it mean to claim that someone was an accidental slave owner? This is a story of mythologies. And one of the most prominent myths in American history is, in fact, the myth of the accidental slave owner, closely related to the myth of the loyal slave, as we'll see. The claim has been made again and again by many pro-slavery figures in the antebellum period, and in a sense by many apologists for for the antebellum South, that there were many accidental slave owners. And most famously, the figure that's at the heart of this story, Bishop James Osgood Andrew, a prominent Methodist bishop, a bishop in the Methodist Episcopal Church, whose slave-owning status in 1844 became a matter of national concern. As some of you know, those of you who've come up in the Methodist tradition know that in 1844, at the great general conference of the Methodist Church in New York City, Northern delegates, having become aware that Bishop Andrew was a slave owner, objected, requested respectfully, according to the resolution, that he withhold the discharging of the duties of the episcopacy until such time as he was could remove himself of that impediment, that is to say, of being a slave owner. This is language that absolutely outraged, among other people, Frederick Douglass, who thought it was far too respectful of a slave owner to simply ask him to consider ceasing to be a slave owner. Nonetheless, the language was so enormously upsetting to the Southern Methodist delegates that they staged an enormous walkout. White Southern Methodist delegates walked out and created the Methodist Episcopal Church South, this being 1844, 1845, and the two great wings of the Methodist Church remained divided until they were reunified in 1939. It's a remarkable story, and one that has been told hundreds of times, again and again, but always with emphasis on the blamelessness, at least in white writings, of Bishop Andrew himself. It's always said that he was simply accidentally a slave owner, that he had inadvertently acquired a number of enslaved people, perhaps 45 over the course of his life, through various marriages and bequests and so forth. And what began to fascinate me, and this really brings us to our opening slide here, is that there was a very different version of the story that had been told again and again in Oxford, Georgia, in African-American families. This is a story that revolves around the story of Emory College, now Emory University. The story of Bishop Andrew and his blamelessness in reference to slavery had often been told at Emory. But the African-American community in Oxford, Georgia, where all of this transpired, where Emory was founded in 1836, has continued through the generations to emphasize that their understanding was very different. These are, in many cases, the descendants of the major enslaved families that in the 1830s, 1840s, 1850s physically built and cared for Emory College, and in many cases, their descendants through the generations have continued to work at Emory and much more recently to study at Emory. For them, the story was very different. Bishop Andrew was by no means simply an accidental slave owner. And the most famous person whom he owned, the woman known as Miss Kitty, that Dr. Haywood just mentioned, was hardly treated benevolently. The bishop always claimed that he had acquired Miss Kitty through a complex bequest from Augusta, Georgia, at some point in the 1820s from a wealthy woman in Augusta, and that he had taken her on, offered her freedom in 1841 when she turned 19, by offering to send her to Liberia, that she refused out of loyalty to him and to his wife, and that therefore to reward her, he had built for her a cottage, a little house behind the big house, behind his house, where she was allowed to live in perfect freedom, or as much freedom as the laws of Georgia would allow. And that's the standard story that was repeated again and again. The very slave quarters were built that had been built were lovingly restored by the white community. I'm going to move forward a little bit to show you. We do know what Bishop Andrew looks like. There are several contemporary paintings. It's speculative as to what Miss Kitty looked like. For the African-American families, however, it was a very different story. This was not a benevolent relationship of virtual freedom. It's widely believed in the community that Miss Kitty was the enforced mistress of Bishop Andrew, that the reason she was moved out of the big house, moved into this small house behind the big house, was so the bishop could have unfettered sexual access to her, and that he was in all likelihood the father at least of one of her children. There was a great deal of argumentation to this day, but most of it is a quiet kind of argumentation because the dominant white story had until very recently so predominated, it's essentially written up in the Methodist Book of Discipline, the claim that Bishop Andrew was blameless in the entire affair because he'd simply acquired slaves through his second wife, and so forth. And this actual story is much more complex. But I'm going to read a little bit to give you a sense of the enormous pain and anguish that this continuous retelling of the story takes. This story is deeply beloved in the white community. As I say, it's been not only published in hundreds of sites, but for many, many years, school children were led through Old Church, the great church in the heart of Oxford, the place where Emory had been founded, and then taken around to the lovingly restored slave cottage called Kitty's Cottage, where they were told essentially that slavery was a benevolent institution. And you have to imagine this, perhaps 50 school children being bused in, coming in, and being told by the leaders of the white community that slavery really hadn't been all that bad, and that Miss Kitty, as an example, had chosen out of loyalty to her white master and mistress to stay in slavery. So I start on one particular day after this long lecture on Miss Kitty, in which a fifth grade student, African-American student, bravely raised her hand and asked, "Did they treat the girl like a slave?" Or, and the white teacher repeated the question for Mr. Porter, the white guide, who was cupping his ear. "Did they treat Kitty like a slave, or was she like one of the family?" asked the white teacher. Mr. Porter responded, "Oh, she was like one of the family. They were called servants in the bishop's home. A lot of families treated people well." The teacher thanked him, and the students then shuffle outside and go back and are taken on a tour through the slave quarters, which was a very sort of beautifully restored, and it looks like a rather nice, cozy cottage. Later that afternoon, John Plitty, J.P. Godfrey Jr., one of two African-Americans on the Oxford City Council, sat in the living room of his cousin Margaret Watkins as he told her about Martin Porter's presentation, which he had listened to while seated quietly in a rear pew of the church. "Well, Margaret," he sighed, "all I can say is that Martin was in fine form that morning. He had those children eating right out of his hand. Why, you know, Miss Kitty was just one of the family, and they just loved her so much they couldn't get enough of her." Margaret laughed ruefully. "I'll say they loved her," she said. "Or at least the bishop did, making her his mistress and all that." J.P. continued, "And she just wanted to stay in slavery so much she just pleaded with the bishop to keep her." Margaret continued in the same sardonic vein, quote, "That's right, slavery was just a regular social welfare system, just took care of all your needs, no worries at all." Laughing, she added, quote, "That's why she just needed but a moment to decide when that chance was offered her in 1841 that she wanted to be a slave forever." J.P. chuckled as he responded, "And I just love the part that Kitty was just too ignorant to know slavery was being argued about all over the country, since she was, quote, just as innocent as she could be," which was one of the repeated lines in the tour. "She had no idea about the coming storm clouds, too busy cooking and cleaning, after all." Margaret smiled impishly and looked over at me. "It's just like grandmother used to say, quote, what did white people think we were doing all day in the kitchen? Just cooking? No, sir, we were..." And then she and J.P. simultaneously delivered the beloved punchline passed down through the generations of their extended family. "We were listening." "White people just plumb forgot we were listening to everything," J.P. delightedly repeated as they both rocked back and forth with laughter. Then J.P. suddenly stopped smiling as his face took on a look of pain. He leaned forward, his voice now low. "But seriously, Margaret, we have to do something about this. We just can't keep letting these lies get delivered to our children. Somebody has to tell them the truth for a change." Margaret took his hand and held it for a long moment in silence as she looked at him and quietly nodded. And it's these quiet moments, in fact, repeated again and again in the community that struck me so much when I began to teach at Emory and to spend a lot of time in the surrounding African-American communities around the Oxford College, the initial campus of the university. Again and again, this story of Miss Kitty came up so many times. In 1939, the chairman of the Emory Board of Trustees, so concerned over the coming, reunification of the Methodist Church nationally, which he believed was going to lead to the placement of, quote, Negro bishops, of African-American bishops from the North over white Southern congregations, decided that the story of Miss Kitty needed to be preserved for all time. And he paid for the erection of this elaborate cenotaph over where he believed more or less Kitty to be buried at the precise entry to the historical white cemetery where many African-American, on the other side of the cemetery, many African-Americans are buried. But on this white cemetery, she's at the boundary. and it gives the official White story of Miss Kitty and Bishop Andrew, that he had offered to free her. She stayed in freedom willingly, and by implication, slavery was a fairly benevolent system. I'll just show you a little map giving you a sense of where Oxford, or what was originally Emory College, is located, and you'll see there's an African-American cemetery and a white cemetery. And there are two large trees that were there, the gateway oaks that mark the entrance or the pearly gates to the white cemetery, and that's precisely, in fact, where Miss Kitty was located. She's actually buried now, we think, in Bishop Andrew's family plot. That's where he clearly wanted her to be buried. But you can see the marker placed in 1939 that welcomes, in a sense, this was often the story, the Miss Kitty, who had a warm, generous personality, called, she's still to this day called in the white community Kitty, or occasionally Mammy Kitty. In the African-American community, she's referred to as Miss Kitty, and the use of that honorific is, of course, a significant difference. But the notion was that here she is at the boundary between the historically African-American and the historically white cemetery, the only person of color acknowledged publicly to be buried within that white cemetery. In 1939, when it becomes clear that the Methodist Church is, in fact, reunifying, and there's enormous fear that this will lead to a challenge to the segregationist system, the white leadership of Emory and of Oxford arranged to transport the old slave cabin to an all-white Methodist religious campground in Salem, about 12 miles away, where it becomes the Kitty Cottage Museum, a very important museum to the lost cause, to the old Confederacy, with a lot of stories about the loyalty of Miss Kitty and, of, by extension, of all people of color to the old Confederacy, with portraits of Stonewall Jackson and Robert E. Lee and so forth. Interestingly enough, it's many elderly white members of the community recall that it is a great place of love, of affection, of kindness, where Miss Kitty, it is said, took such good care of all the white children of the community. So it's part of the story of the help. Many elderly whites also recall that the first kiss that they ever had was exchanged in this very benevolent place. And here you can see in this image how the cottage actually marked the entrance as you're moving towards the tabernacle of this very important religious campground. In 1994, the cottage is brought back to Oxford, Georgia. It's lovingly restored by the white community with a lot of effort and money. And then to the great shock of the white community, who had never, no one in the white community had thought to consult with the African-American half of the city about this. When the day was opened, they expected people to come streaming in. And to this day, practically not a single adult African-American citizen in Newton County, Georgia, has been willing to enter into those doors. Because, of course, for them, as so many people emphasize, this is not a place of love. This is a place of violation, a place of terror, even a place of rape. At least that's how it's understood, based on the stories that have traveled down across the generations. I was, not so long ago, as several older women in the African-American community were standing, contemplating if they should go in, several of them began to quote a passage from Toni Morrison's Beloved, in which Setha says to Denver, and Denver, of course, not really knowing directly the world of slavery, and Setha says, you know, Denver, you think it's over and done with, but if you go in there, it's still waiting for you. If you go there, it's still waiting for you. And precisely what, Morrison, of course, leaves it a little unclear, but we know essentially that something to do with the horrors and terrors of slavery is still present these many years after formal emancipation. And that's precisely the line that has been quoted several times in reference, that there's something waiting in there, that it is not a place of love, that, of course, that it is a place of terror. Now, there have been interesting attempts, especially in response to some of my early published writings on this subject, to sort of reclaim Miss Kitty and resituate her in another place. A large Afrocentric church in Lithonia, Georgia, just outside of Atlanta, traveled several years ago on Juneteenth for an ancestral walk, walking through the old Emory campus, past Old Church, where so many important sermons had been given in defense of slavery in the antebellum period. And then they came, poured out libations. They actually gave Miss Kitty a new name in the Ewe language, a name which basically translated as Beloved of God, and poured out libations and danced in her honor and so forth to sort of reclaim her. This actually was, of course, many members of the white community thought there was a race riot going on, called the police. But many local African Americans also objected because here was a church that had come into basically the area of local African American churches without consulting with them, and that there was a strong feeling in the local churches, both the local Methodist and the local Baptist churches, that they had been looking over Miss Kitty and praying on her and praying on the question of what had happened to her children and so forth for many, many years. So you had a sort of tangled web, not only a question of race, but also questions of social class. This was a rather wealthier congregation than many local African Americans who felt that yet again Miss Kitty was being used and abused for other people's purposes. Very, very complicated moment. So I thought at first that I would use that title that Dr. Haywood introduced the book with. That was the original title of the book, The Accidental Slave Owner, Revisiting a Myth of the American South. And I actually started to give little talks like this in the fellowship halls of local African-American churches as I was explaining the project that I was working on. I'm trained as an anthropologist. I'm deeply interested in myth and how stories of faith and race travel across the generations in American society. Everybody listened politely. And then members of the mother board stood up from several different churches to say, you know, Professor, it's all very nice that you're doing all this on myths, but you know, we're not myths. And there's just something wrong with talking about us like we're myths. So, of course, I tried to backtrack. But here I was expecting. I had all my students present. I thought I would get a lot of positive feedback. And people were perfectly pleased that I was doing the historical research, but wanted more than that. And as Ms. Nora Simonson, who was the eldest woman on the mother board of Mount Zion Baptist, said, you know, we're not just myths, we're families. This story of what happened to Miss Kitty is not just the story of, it's not just a story, it's the story of a real woman, a strong black woman, who suffered terribly over the years. But the worst of her suffering came when she passed. When she passed, she was no longer allowed to stay with her own people, to rest for eternity in our side of the cemetery. She was buried over in the bishop's plot next to the bishop. And that, for me, she said, is the final indignity, that she wasn't even allowed to stay with her own people, she had warmed his bed in life, and now she was forced to stay with him in the grave for eternity. And even worse than that, this woman who supposedly, we hear, was supposed to allow and be treated as if she was free, what about those three children? We know she had two sons and a daughter, and that they were taken away by the bishop a few years later, still during slavery times, as slaves, when he went off somewhere west. And we have, for 150 years in this town, been preying on those children. There are so many thousands gone, she said, so many thousands gone whose names we will never know. But those three children, we would like to know their names. We would like to know what became of them. We would like to know what became of their posterity. And if you're talking about a partnership, and I think partnerships are a fine thing, young man, she said, then you need to work on partnering with us to find those descendants and bring those children home to us so we can welcome them. This was about 4 years ago, and it seemed an impossible tall order. I mean, you know, I felt just tracking the myths was enough. So I began to work very closely with many people in the community, including many people in the... and here's a little more of the of this very moving ceremony. And then I came across this document. For those of you who work in African American history, of course, Freeman's Bank documents are enormously important for tracing family history. It turns out that Miss Kitty did, in fact, have a husband who was an enslaved African American man named Nathan Boyd, who survived the period of slavery after emancipation. In 1871, he's living, in fact, in Atlanta, Georgia. He's a rather well-to-do cook and quite involved in the founding of several African-American fraternal organizations. Interestingly enough, he lists as his wife, Catherine, dead. This is 20 years after Kitty had died. And it was enormously moving, I think, for us to... We'd always refer to her as Kitty or Miss Kitty, to recognize, to be reminded that Kitty was a diminutive, essentially a slave name used by... the slave-owning class, but Catherine was the name through which her husband had referred to her. We see three children, Alfred, Nathan, Emma L. And that, combined with a few other hints in Bishop Andrew's biography, made it possible for me finally to begin to trace what had happened to the children, that Emma had married into a sharecropping family, come to live in Pine Bluff, Arkansas. Her son was a dentist who then died without issue. Russell Nathan Boyd, the middle son, had a fascinating life. made his way after slavery to Washington, D.C., where he became, in time, a librarian in the U.S. Department of State, was a keeper of the Declaration of Independence, of important map collections, represented the United States in its, negotiations over the Alaska-Canada boundary, and was also a prominent figure in African-American religious life, became a member of 15th Street Presbyterian Church, and became the senior trustee at that church, working very closely with Reverend Francis Grimke, and involved in many of the events leading up to the founding of the NAACP. He passed in 1921. And the eldest son, Alfred, also remained a man of faith. He escaped from slavery, we finally learned, and in time became an ordained minister in Iowa in the African Methodist Episcopal Church. So he stayed within the Methodist discipline, but he moved outside, of course, of the Methodist Episcopal Church south of the bishop, and founded many important AME congregations in Iowa and Illinois. Finally, my wife, Ellen, who's here, she and I spent a summer sort of tracing that part of the story, going through little Iowa towns, and finally found in Rockford, Illinois, we're able to go to Allen Chapel AME Church, which Reverend Boyd had pastored in the early 20th century, and there the eldest trustee of the church was, in fact, the great-grandson of Reverend Boyd, that is to say, Miss Kitty's great-great-grandson, and through him I got to become very close to his adult daughters in Philadelphia, who knew an enormous amount of family history back until April 7, 1865, and then their great-great-grandfather wouldn't talk about anything that happened before the day he escaped from slavery. But I had the story, of course, from the 1790s up until that day, and we were able to put things together, and it was enormously moving and exciting. And then it became feasible that perhaps what the community had been asking in Oxford, Georgia for so long, that it would be possible to bring them home. They were very, quote, bring them home. Now, they were very wary of all of this, especially going back to Emory College, which had been so prominent, Emory University had been so prominent in the defense of slavery through the years. So there was a lot of discussion back and forth. Finally, several things happened. We put on a large international conference, as some of you know, on slavery in universities at Emory, and in the leading up to that and leading up to the invitation for Miss Kitty's descendants to return back to Emory and to Oxford, the Emory Board of Trustees in January of this year passed a resolution, a statement of deep regret for the institution's entwinement in slavery and in the sins of Jim Crow. It wasn't a full apology, but it's a further public statement than really any university, including Brown, has been willing to go in terms of recognizing the depth of its moral complicity in the system of slavery and racial oppression and racial apartheid in the United States. So that really made it possible for them to come back. But then there was this great question. I'm just going to move quickly. There's a complex family chain of all of these family members that then slowly we were able to reconstruct, all the way down to Darcel and Cynthia at the very bottom of this chart, the great-great-great-granddaughters of Miss Kitty, and or of Catherine Boyd and her husband Nathan Boyd. But then the question was, well, what should happen? There was a deep sense that they had that their families had been ruptured all these years, and the very first thing that they wanted to do, once I explained that we had more or less located where Nathan Boyd was buried in Oakland Cemetery in Atlanta in 1875, so a special ceremony was conducted, bringing together many members of the Oxford and Emory communities to honor his memory. And here are the great-great-great-granddaughters of Miss Kitty. I've been looking for them, you know, of course, for really, in a sense, for 12 years, and it was wonderful to meet them and to become, and for them to take so much ownership, of course, of the story. We did a wreath-laying, and that's an interesting little headstone that had been placed by the white leaders of the white community in the year 2000, precisely at the point that the town was being torn apart. The white community's leadership was still trying to maintain a segregated cemetery and an all-white police force. So they put this headstone in at that moment, thinking that that would sort of satisfy the African-American community. Of course, it didn't. And the fact that they used a name that was regarded as a patent lie, calling her Kitty, using the name Shell, which was the name of the slave owner of her husband, and not the name he used, was also considered offensive. Still, so it was a sort of charged moment. They visited the library, especially Emory's Special Collections, where many of you have done work, where so many of the documents that had led us to them were found. It was all very moving. But then the local community, especially at Grace United Methodist Church in Covington, Georgia, where so many of the African-American really community historians, women historians especially, all really for more than a century had kept alive their version of the story and had been preying on the question of what had happened to Miss Kitty and her children, became very interested in partnering to create something to welcome them back, a work of art. They began to work very closely with the African-American artist Lynn Marshall Linnemeyer, who works very closely with the Yoruba ritual specialist. She initially proposed doing something, a kind of agan, the Yoruba agungun. This is, of course, in the Ifa tradition. And the community kind of liked the cloth idea, but they suggested, let's do a quilt instead. We're more familiar with a quilt. That seems to us, quilts, the very works that were made by our grandmothers and great-grandmothers. So Lynn was okay with that, and they began to work together. They occupied the old city hall of Oxford, began to scan in hundreds of family photographs. The idea was the best way to welcome people back was to bring together all of these different long-lost images, images both of the family that had been wrenched apart from the community and of everything that, and of the families that had stayed behind as names of the enslaved people who had built Emory in the time in the 1830s and 1840s were read aloud by elders in the community as well as by young people. It was a very moving moment as finally this elaborate tapestry or really collage of all these different stories. And I'll just mention a few points. You'll see the central figure here under a great tree of life. The congregation very much wanted to show what had happened. So here we see actually Miss Kitty's eldest son, Reverend Alfred Boyd, and his wife Malvina. But next to him, to sort of put the different strands of Methodism together, is Bishop B.L. King, who was a very important bishop, who rises to the episcopacy in 1940, but then is immediately shunted off to the central jurisdiction, which was when the two wings of the Northern and Southern Church, Methodist Church, came together in 1939, there was a kind of classic sellout by Northern and Southern whites, we now feel, creating this artificial jurisdiction for people of color, the so-called central jurisdiction. And so it's been a continuous source of pain in the community that the bishop was not fully on. Bishop King, a very great man who had been part, in fact, of the pastorate at Grace in earlier years, was not fully honored. So the community took, as you can see, this. They sort of took the project over from the artist. The artist had wanted to do something with bridal symbolism, with the veil and so forth, partly because of her interest in the veiling of Orisha in Yoruba Ifa ceremonies. But the veil was instead used to cover, rather to her surprise, the face of Bishop King. And there are several different allusions going on. One, of course, is to Du Bois's image in The Soul of Black Folks of course, the veil of double consciousness of racial prejudice. He's still looking out, people emphasize, but he is looking through the veil. But there are also associations with the Ark of the Covenant, and there are probably other scriptural reference that I may not. There's a sort of sense of holiness at the center of this, that of all of these families that were once torn apart, a lot of discussion of, and the work has been subsequently reinstalled in the church and moved around in various ways. A lot of community conversation about this image of two African-American girls who are known to have been given as a dowry gift within a very prominent white Georgia family. And you see what's been written here just in the last year, the word gifted. So on the one hand, a reference to the fact that they were given as gifts, of course, and torn apart from their own mother, in the interest of reproducing an elite white family structure, but also gifted in the sense of course, that they are that they have God-given gifts of dignity and intelligence and so forth. So these kinds of double plays run through a lot of this the work, juxtaposition between post-emancipation images and also names of enslaved people who are known to have built the college, with images of doves, of harbingers, of both of warning and of hope and aspiration, documents related, historical documents related to the history of slavery in the community, along with other more recently deceased men and women who are being honored here as ancestors. So the general notion of the agunglin of a of a textile based way of pulling together in many different panels veneration for ancestors whose names are known and not known. That continues, but it's done in a quite different way, as you can see in this work. And here, of course, we have Reverend Boyd, J.P. Godfrey, who I mentioned at the very beginning. He's honored. That's his father in a World War I uniform, and so forth. Many enslaved members of the community who then lived on into the Reconstruction and post-Reconstruction era are also honored. Here we have Sarah Robinson Mitchell and Robert Mitchell. You can see there's been a sort of loving process of colorizing these old black and white photographs, very reminiscent, people explained to me, of the old family Bibles in which the Holy Family was always illuminated. The two individuals we just saw come out of people enslaved by Bishop Andrew himself and by his close friend Alexander Means. Also, a lot of joy in this particular photograph. This is Joe Pierce Jr., a very distinguished African-American mathematician who was at Atlanta University and then the president of Texas Southern University. Now, he has a fascinating family history within Methodist history. His grandfather was the very famous white Methodist bishop George Foster Pierce, one of Georgia's arch segregationists, perhaps the most intense advocate of the disenfranchisement of African Americans from the pulpit within Reconstruction era Georgia. He was, of course, a great opponent of Reconstruction, and had been a major slave owner and a major advocate of, among other things, the post-slavery penal agrarian system. Nonetheless, he had as a white family and an African American family, leading to this line. And everybody in the community and the congregation was just thrilled when, at the unveiling of to welcome back the descendants of Miss Kitty, also his descendants came. Here we have Dr. Joseph Pierce Jr., who's actually known to some people here at BU because he's a prominent African, of course, a very prominent anesthesiologist and also a prominent patron of the African American art scene. Came up from San Antonio, Texas, with his wife, Arinetta. And there they are, as you can see, posing next to the photograph. So it was a very complex family reunion, not just of Miss Kitty's descendants, but of many other people that are brought together, as well as lots of ordinary people who are remembered in this very complex work, often moving towards this story, hands, traces, no direct representations of Miss Kitty, but a sense constantly of her, of a handprint that recalls the loving touch of the ancestral mother. But I'd like to bring this to a close with a sense of what this actually meant for the larger fabric of the community, that it took really 10 years of deep conversation to get people in the white and African-American sectors of this community to actually come together in conversation and in fellowship and in worship to talk about the burdens of slavery in the community. And there was, after that cloth descended, a very powerful and moving conversation by the descendants of major enslaving families, major slave-owning families, and the major enslaved families who had built Emory, about this complex history. But it had taken a long time to get there. And I want to go back in time in this to talk a little bit about the work that really made it possible for everyone to come together. And it wasn't just the work of historical research, as much as important as that was. It was a certain form of physical labor. As I mentioned, the two cemeteries in the city of Oxford, Georgia, had been deeply divided. There had been a sort of implicit or informal arrangement that had existed really since the 1830s. But everything tightened up enormously in 1965. It's really the passage of the various Civil Rights Acts and the Voting Rights Act, paradoxically, that led to intensification of racial segregation in the cemetery. The white power structure privatized the white cemetery, created a cemetery foundation, and all funding that was allotted, including all African-American burial fees to care for the African-American side of the cemetery in perpetuity, were transferred under the table by the all-white city council for 35 years to look after the white cemetery. And then the claim was constantly made, and this was a very common pattern in many parts of course, of the post-civil rights, the so-called post-civil rights South, that privatization and other neoliberal strategies have been used to sort of manage things. Then the claim was always made, well, if the African American community really cared, they would take care of their cemetery. But of course, the funding was all being directed in this particular direction. I thought this was for my students. I was teaching a lot of freshmen at that point in an introduction to sociology class, and I thought, well, this is just a good object lesson in how things work, power, space, race in the South. But my students got very upset and said, well, you know, isn't the point not just to analyze the world but to change it? Why aren't we doing something about this? Well, you know, it was hard to argue with them. So we had an interesting meeting with the in the Fellowship Hall of Mount Zion Baptist, again, with the whole with representatives of all the major faith communities in the county. And they said, yeah, okay, you know, we'll do it. You know, under certain conditions, everything should be done guided by our community historians. There should be documentation as well as restoration of that cemetery. And so, well, we all showed up on the first Saturday, a little nervous. We had done some work. As some of you know, a lot of my work has been involved with memorializing victims of lynching in Georgia. And my students and I, working with community organizations, had tried to restore other cemeteries in which victims of lynching were buried, and there had been threats by members of the Klan and so forth. So we were a little nervous about this, and I'll read a little bit. We were mindful of this recent history on the first day of the project. As Rob, a silent, burly ex-Marine, a white man in his 50s who kept company only with two large German shepherds, strode purposely toward the cemetery. So you have to imagine, it's a group of faculty and students. The faculty, a little uncertain which is the business end of a saw, trying to lead students in this community restoration project. Okay. So J.P. Godfrey and I walked forward, a little nervously to meet him. But Rob had no time for chip-chat. Looking at the 40 students working with limited efficiency on the privet and bramble, Rob declared, "Never did set right with me, the town treating this ground like that." He immediately got to work, teaching the young men in my class, to their unending delight, how to use chainsaws and how to bring down dead tree branches and haul them away in his pickup. Rob came to work every session over the subsequent year, up until the day he was diagnosed with a terminal illness. His final months were often agony, but he was no longer a loner. Women in the Mount Zion and Rust Chapel congregations took turns bringing him covered dishes and sat on the porch with him chatting. Their children and grandchildren dispatched to take his dogs for regular walks. These are the same grandmothers who had been warning the children off of the dogs for years. His internment at his request in the African American cemetery was well attended by his African American neighbors. For cemeteries do not simply serve to help us remember the dead. They also serve to produce kinship, to expand the bonds of family. And Rob, somewhere along the way, was adopted, without any fuss, into the beloved community. I once asked Nora Simonson, on the church motherboard, if she had ever harbored any resentment toward Rob. He hadn't ever marched during the civil rights movement. He hadn't ever protested gerrymandering or the thousand indignities imposed on local African Americans every day during the many years after he came back from Vietnam. At least that's what I pointed out. And she just smiled at me, quote, "He was a hard worker, and you know, sweat-producing labor is soul-cleansing labor. He's family now, that's all I can say," close quote. One day, gazing at Rob hacking away at a tree limb, his tan torso perspiring in the sun, Deacon Henry, also of Mount Zion Baptist, had joked, "You sweating like an old field hand. Never thought I'd see the day." And it's interesting, in a rural Southern context, quote, sweat-producing labor by a white man toiling on behalf of the very African Americans whose families had worked that very land as slaves and sharecroppers, that image of sweat-producing labor is deeply resonant. Of course, I write this as an anthropologist. I work primarily in sub-Saharan Africa. And recalling Rob, I can't help thinking of a question posed to another anthropologist, to the anthropologist Judy Rosenthal, by the Ewe community members in southern Togo with whom she worked. Quote, "Why should you white Americans not pay your debts to the slave spirits the way we Ewe do? You would be better off for it. Some of them died violently. Their spirits are powerful. They can help heal and protect you when you need them if you would only honor them fully," unquote. I can't help but wonder, as he labored, did Rob come in a sense to be possessed by the dead men and women of the cemetery, by those who had worked the land on behalf of his own white ancestors? In any event, this was a question we were all sort of thinking of several days later in early April when we all gathered together because my students had found some interesting documents. They've been working, these were again freshmen and sophomores, they've been working on this very history of the cemetery and had come across in the basement of the county courthouse a series of receipts paid to slave catchers, especially during the Civil War. One script read, Conyers, Georgia, October 2, 1864, estate of Dr. Cody to John W. Allen for arresting four Negroes, V.I.Z., Rose and her three children, and expenses connected with the same. And this is October 64, he had been paid $500. So we began to realize quickly as we started to look through the maps, the students had sort of tracked this, that Rose and the three children had run from Oxford, Georgia, from an estate closely connected with the leaders of Emory, directly towards what's now I-20, directly to Conyers, trying to escape to Union lines, because at this point, of course, Sherman's forces had occupied Atlanta, which was liberated at that point. But it was a very dangerous run that they were taking through intensive artillery fire. And the students, who had all just read Beloved, were very worried. Ethically, would they be representing Rose as having endangered the lives of her children by taking them into the heart of the battlefield at this point? They didn't know what to do, so we had another community meeting in the fellowship hall, and the students nervously stood up, showed the documents, and asked for guidance from the community. After a long silence, Deacon Henry rose to speak. Quote, all my life I've heard white folks saying slavery was just a regular social security system, looking after people cradle to grave, and I never said anything. This woman, Miss Rose, I don't know who her kin were. She could be lying right out there in the cemetery all these years. But she said something. She said to her children, we are going to be free, even if we walk into the mouth of the cannon, yea, even if we walk through the valley of the shadow of death, nothing holding us back. She said something. Alice Thompson of the Church Mother Board nodded and said, she's saying something now. 2 weeks later, on the exhibition's opening night, and the students have been working on developing an exhibition in the college library, there was singing and constant conversation, joking and laughing in front of all the family photos and elegant heirlooms local families had lent for the show. But when people got to the corner where the slave catcher's receipt hung, conversation always stopped, as each person slowly deciphered the old script and pondered the caption. Miss Alice's husband, James, took off his trademark hat and stood still. Miss Alice squeezed my hand and said quietly, she's saying something now. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Mark. And I wondered why the notion of using Yoruba to represent the religious, African religious background. And together with that, I wonder if there have been any sort of DNA testing of the descendants to sort of figure out where exactly, mm-hmm. at least in terms of the maternal line.
Yeah, two interesting questions, important questions. So I would say the Yoruba influence does not come from the local community. I mean, the Yoruba interest comes out of, there's a sort of class dimension to this. I would say many leading figures in the African-American bourgeoisie in Atlanta, including the artist Lynn Linnemeyer, she's a close friend, but she's very Yoruba-oriented. She's very much oriented towards the Ifa tradition, as are the ritual specialists with whom she works. For those of us who work more, for example, in the Bakongo or other traditions, have sort of watched with interest. So I would say that while the local, essentially working-class community in Oxford, Georgia, has been perfectly willing for some of this. They also want a narrative that's much more inclusive. So there's been a lot of compromise about this. And I would say they've been very drawn recently, especially over enormous concern over violence, especially directed towards African-American men, both in the prison industrial complex, and also just within the community. They've been very fascinated by another artist, Kevin Sipp, who's very much more engaged with, I would say, Congo traditions. He's constructed a series of very large nkisi of power figures that are really trees that draw also on bottle tree traditions to create a space for the victims of lynching, because it's widely believed locally that one of the reasons that young men join gangs is that they're in downtown Atlanta, for instance, is that they're being pursued constantly at night in nightmares. And for this artist, Kevin Sipp, the great anxiety is because they are, in fact, the reborn souls of lynched figures and therefore are drawn into cycles of violence, which they take out, in fact, on their peers. So he's trying to create, with community work, this alternate sense, using the symbolism of the Nkisi, to create a space where those souls can finally come to rest to break the silence, the cycles of violence. And that's deeply resonated, I would say, with many of the community members that we're talking about. Now, in the DNA question, it's interesting. Some of the white descendants and collateral relatives of Bishop Andrew have expressed openness to DNA testing. But at this point, the African-American descendants of Miss Kitty, they are still, they say, getting used to it. We're getting used to knowing our new cousins on the African-American side. They haven't ruled it out as a possibility, but they said they're just not willing to walk through that door yet. But the story may change.
You know, this is marvelous. I really, you know, I'm grateful to you for sharing this research and the sort of, you know, the things that we wouldn't know how that book was put together. We really are enriched by your presentation, and we are thankful and grateful to you for sharing it. Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Dr. Mark Auslander, Associate Professor of Anthropology and Museum Studies and Director of the Museum of Culture and Environment at Central Washington University. Dr. Auslander's lecture was titled The Accidental Slave Owner, Revisiting a Myth of Race and Finding an American Family, and was presented by the Boston University African American Studies Program and co-sponsored by the Anthropology Department and the African Studies Center. Tonight's moderator was African American Studies Program Director Linda Haywood. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Paul Vikas. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.